Government Office, Betrayal Trust of the city of Santa Cruz and its heritage. I mean, we're talking about not only urban agriculture with this initiative, but we're talking about an institution that's been praised on the floor of the United States Congress. It's just really going to be a night of shame and disgrace, and I imagine there will be some outrage, and that outrage needs to be funneled and perhaps turned into a recall campaign. It's come to that. I really hate to say it. I think that the progressive community needs unity now more than ever. Hillary's warned us about the massive right-wing conspiracy, and I don't have much doubt with the behavior of the police everywhere that there's fascism and Nazism rampant throughout our country.
Well, I'm certainly going to be at that meeting, and I hope that some of you listeners will be there too, or giving a call to 429-3550. The phone number for the city council, which you can call in on and leave a message on at any time. There's also a meeting the day before of the Citizens Police Review Board. Or is it the Police Citizens Review Board? I'm not sure which it is. In any case, this is their monthly meeting. I continue to monitor this group. I'm not sure why. Probably because I've got time on my hands. That must be the reason. On the agenda for this is a monthly meeting that they have. These are seven members of the community appointed by this, each one by a city council member. These are the people who gave us the Happy John Dine cover-up. These are the people who gave us the anything Belcher does is okay process. Belcher is our police chief around the issues of where John Malkin resigned and the board refused to consider complaints that by Malkin that he was being politically surveilled by Sergeant Clark, and no doubt as a part of the review police officer directive.
These are the people that sat on my case for 6 months while Internal Affairs reviewed it a second time and didn't even bother to submit the report in time. So that the complaint didn't expire. I mean, they have a six-month period. If you have a complaint, if you've been beaten by the police like I have, then 6 months after your complaint, if they haven't taken action, it just dies. You know, and it's to their loss. It's their mistake. I mean, this was an opportunity for some kind of mediation between me and the city, and now they've got it, so it's going to court, and you know, they're going to lose $3 million. So fuck them.
Well, this, of course, it referred to the incident in September of 1996, when you, David, were attempting to pick up some petitions that had been essentially dropped on the ground after a peaceful homeless protester was tackled by Sergeant Andy Crane.
It wasn't even while I was attempting to pick up those petitions. I successfully picked up those petitions, gathered them, gave them to the city clerk, and I resumed my spot and went over to stand next to the other candidates. And I was singled out from amongst other candidates and hurled out of the council chambers violently.
Right, and you then crashed into a pillar outside, and this kind of ended your campaign for city council, which you found yourself you continued to try to do, but I guess you were severely disadvantaged as you tried to do it the rest of that fall.
I was disadvantaged, and I mean physically, I was no longer able to walk precincts, and the foundation of my whole campaign was that I'd knock every door in the city of Santa Cruz. Being an HIV person, I thought that would be a good, you know, policy to have, to make sure people to let them know I was okay. But I was not okay after this incident. And also, I had pretty much lined up the Central Labor Council endorsement, and I was expecting to receive it the following night. Well, that next morning, there I was on the front page of the Santa Cruz Sentinel, wide-eyed radical thrown out of city council chambers. You know, that doesn't usually go well in a Central Labor Council endorsement meeting.
You were not endorsed.
No, even though I had promises from many presidents and vice presidents, and I had the thing pretty well lined up. I got the Teamsters, and I got my home union. You know, but the Teamsters aren't fooled much by police press tactics.
Well, so that's the political ramifications, and of course we're talking about the Citizens Police Review Board that's happening tomorrow at 5:30. That is usually I've gone. What I usually do at those meetings is I go and I speak during the rather long oral communications period to the board, but I'm not entirely clear why I do, since the only people it gets to are sitting at the table and don't seem particularly interested, and the I guess it also gets to the tapes, so you can't actually listen to past. If you miss a city council meeting, or if you miss a Citizens Police Review Board meeting, you can always go and listen to it in the public library, where those tapes are available. So this is happening tomorrow, Monday, The Citizens Police Review Board meets. They're going to be talking about, they're going to be discussing their hearing procedures and the presence of an internal affairs officer at the CPRB review hearings. I'm reluctant to even descend into these details, since the general unwillingness of this board to deal with issues of justice has become really clear to me in the last few years. But I will also say, as I've often said, that if you have a complaint to file, you should still file it with these folks to make a record. And what's really needed, of course, are dozens and dozens of people to show up at these hearings and demand action on certain items that might have some impact. What they're going to be talking about tomorrow is hearing procedures. They've never had a hearing. Their hearings are, let me put it this way, all their hearings are held in private, in closed session. We've asked for there to be public hearings, but they've refused, even in the most serious case of all, that of the murder, a killing, sorry, of Happy John Dine. Some say it's a murder, some say it's manslaughter, some say it's justifiable homicide. There's general agreement, however, that among many of us, that there was misinformation by the police chief about the issue, still not corrected, and a whole series of discrepancies which cry out for some kind of real investigation and public hearings, which the Police Review Board has refused to do. And Santa Cruzans, for full disclosure, one of the groups that I've been involved with that has been interested in this is still interested in your input. You want to leave a message on the Huff line, the 423-4833-423-HUFF line. You can do that. Give a call there. And let us know. There's we still get inquiries from folks who are really interested in what's going on with the Happy John Dine case. And of course, the answer is, at the moment, the Happy John Dine case is as dead as Happy John Dine, unfortunately, although it's not, for many of us, it still continues. Any thoughts on that, David?
Well, that's another thing. It really quite surprised me when I was at the Fred Keeley kickoff campaign, that there were very established, you know, big people in the Democratic Party who were saying, what the hell is going happened with that John Dine thing? You know, that's just outrageous. And there were people that I would consider to be real moderate that were outraged. And there was a person that, I don't know if I should repeat his name, I think you should have him on the show real soon, Paul Ehrlich, who was just totally outraged. I mean, he couldn't believe that this was all allowed to go down. I think you should have Paul on the show for give his perspective. He's a beautiful man. He was a great candidate. It was really one of the saddest things of the 1996 election, besides my loss, was Paul Ehrlich not winning the supervisor seat, County Board of Supervisors. I haven't followed everything with the John Dine case, but it was really clear to me from the very, very beginning that there was cover-up started, that there was the very first page of the report that they have on file in the library is what just contradicts the entire rest of the report, and that's the chief of police's press release. I think the chief of police owes an apology. As a matter of fact, if you watch the final hours and minutes at 1 o'clock or whatever it was in the morning of the Santa Cruz City Council, you heard Scott Kennedy order the chief of police as part of an amendment to them accepting this report from the Citizens Police Review Board, ordering the chief of police to give a report and an accounting of his protocol on releasing these press releases. I would like to see that. He had 60 days to do it. I would like to see that and like to see what he's doing about it. And thanks to Scott Kennedy for having some presence of mind to realize that this was really one of the roots of the whole cover-up process. Whether he calls it a cover-up or they calls it, you know, apparent contradictions, whatever he might phrase it. And I might also add that Rotkin also noticed that the many, many contradictions, the first third of the report, were something that the police need to really respond to. But I'm glad that that amendment was made by Scott Kennedy. I'd like to see something done about that.
Right. Well, don't hold your breath there,
I'm
David.
I'm not holding my breath, however.
we've been through the specifics so many times it becomes tiresome, but the basic reality is the police came out with a report that Dine had a weapon in his hand, was pointing at the police in a combat stance, acting in a threatening manner, and none of these were confirmed. In fact, many of them are openly contradicted by all the non-police witnesses. So when the CPRB, our Citizens Police Review Board, got the case, and put it through their little private process with no public hearings, they came up with the idea that, well, no, he didn't have it in his hand. No, he wasn't pointing at the police. He wasn't in a threatening stance. No, it wasn't combat. But he was reaching for it, and that should be enough. Apropos of which, in today's Sentinel, March 8th, on page 10, we have this. Deputy shoots suspect after high-speed chase. Truckee. A sheriff's deputy fatally shot a suspect late Friday night outside an apartment complex in this northern Sierra town after a high-speed chase. Nevada County Sheriff's deputy said Michael Carter, 34, of Truckee, was shot outside the Truckee Pine Apartments where he allegedly assaulted his girlfriend earlier in the night. Troy Minton Sander, a deputy from neighboring Placer County who assisted in the case, was placed on paid administrative leave after shooting him. Placer Sheriff Edward Bonner said Carter fled the apartment complex in a pickup after the assault and later refused to stop for Placer deputies on Highway 267. A high-speed chase ensued and the suspect returned to the apartment. Once there, the suspect jumped out of his vehicle, refused orders to halt, and appeared to reach for a weapon, Bonner said. The suspect was shot by Minton Sander and transported to Washoe Medical Center in Reno, Nevada, where he was pronounced dead. Note, no toy gun was found at his side on this occasion. David, your view?
Well, I don't know what happened in Truckee. I just read that report just myself just a few minutes ago, but there's been a rash of these kind of shoot first, ask later kind of activities going throughout the state. I guess we're all celebrating the possibility of Dan Lemgon being our next governor. I don't know what the party is about, but the police are definitely hoopla-ing it up everywhere: Salinas, San Jose, and Santa Cruz. It's just murder. There was when I was in January, when I was in Tulare, there was a murder of a suspect. They went into a bar and shot a suspect in Visalia. When the police had their funeral, the people of the city of Visalia are so upset they phoned in bomb threats and they booed the police and threw things at them when they came through the procession. The city of Fresno, same kind of thing happening. So it's, you know, the police are definitely have developed something, some message that has gotten through to them that it's okay for them just to shoot, and also it's okay for them to take care of their personal problems by shooting.
Well, you know, I would have thought that would have been really one of the key questions, even if they found, as they did, that Officer Carey's behavior, Connor Carey was the man who shot Happy John Dine dead on November 12th, found it justifiable, that there would be a reexamination of the process by which guns are used, whether you should shoot to kill or shoot to wound, how you should approach a person supposedly with a gun, whether from behind car doors or whatever. When do you call for backup? Do you wait for the backup? Though, you know, I mean, call me paranoid, but my suspicion is that the reason that none of these questions were raised is because raising them in this context would reveal just how far from the norm this particular situation was with Happy John Dine on November 12th. Namely, the cops did not, for example, hide behind their doors as they came out, thinking...
He hadn't shot three people and robbed a bank. If you shoot three people and rob a bank, then you're part of the police criminal club. Then you get this special respect, and they do all kinds of things, send in negotiators, and they have all kinds of processes. But if you're just a homeless person or a mentally retarded person or a poor person, fuck you.
You know, I mean, well, that was, of course, the view of a number of people.
That's what I see happening. I mean, it's a very clear attitude. The Downtown Association has gone and given the police officers license to do these sweeps and cleanup. And it's obviously this police department does not belong to the citizens. Our city council doesn't belong to the citizens. The police department belongs to the Downtown Association. And the Downtown Association needs to take some responsibility for the death of John Dine, as far as I'm concerned. I said their whole panhandling campaign, their anti-panhandling campaign was so filthy and so disgusting, said that it's just, you wouldn't expect that kind of language in anything except maybe fascist Spain. It's the kind of language that they put out on their real change, not spare change. And now they've got a modified version where they took out a couple of the words that I found that I was opposed to, but they haven't changed the basic tenor of it.
Actually, I was hoping you'd look at that later. We have a copy of that card
here
in the studio on the floor where it probably belongs. And where it probably goes is now, instead of being a little yellow card, it's a blue card. But before we get into that, I just want to kind of conclude this police review thing by reminding you that this is a public process. In other words, they will let you in, and the police review board will let you in to listen to them argue about procedural issues all day and all night. But when it comes to substantive matters about real people who are seeking justice, they will not even allow these people public hearings. And that is really outrageous. We also, in our studio with us again, is Becky Johnson. Becky, what's the word?
I wanted to make a additional comment about the Dine case. I mean, if Connor Carey and Martin Over had not sought any cover or crouched behind doors or protected themselves. Doesn't that seem to indicate that they did not feel threatened by John Dine?
Yeah, it's interesting because we know that Officer Over knew Dine. In fact, he testifies he called him by name as he approached. I mean, there's all kinds of strange things that seem to would have come out if they even began elementary investigation, not into the specifics of whether Carey or Over, you know, were engaging in or abusive behavior, but just general principles. Do you approach someone from behind cover? Do you call for backup? Is it good to have a situation where you're going to shoot to kill? Just general questions that are not just relevant in the Dine case, but are relevant in lots of cases. Had these questions been asked in this case seriously by the Police Review Board? And I if you want to come to the Police Review Board meeting on Monday, you can raise these issues with the Police Review Board. You can ask them to raise these issues with the Police Department. In fact, you can do it without even coming to the Police Review Board meeting. You can give a call to their phone number. It's a 24-hour number, and that phone number is 426. Let me get this right here. Do I have their number here? Yes, I do. 429-3262. That's 429-3262 for the Citizens Police Review Board. Tell them you think these issues should be raised generally as general policy considerations. And also, of course, we've asked the board, Santa Cruzans for Full Disclosure has, of which I'm one of the members, to rehold hearings so that they can at least discuss the process of their why they came to the decisions they did, which witnesses they believed, which witnesses they didn't believe, what evidence they found that was persuasive, and so on.
And if Martin Over stated that if the CPRB concluded that John Dine was shot while he was reaching for the gun, how come Martin Over wasn't disciplined for reporting that he was pointing the gun?
Well, perhaps as Alan Lang said on community television, there was a millisecond between those two positions.
Well, I think it's significant whether he was reaching for it or pointing for it, and if somebody is misreporting something that crucial, they should be disciplined.
Well, you know, there's this old saying, you know, that the first victim of war, first casualty of war is the truth. And I think we really, really ought to accept the fact that there is a war on the poor, and the truth is definitely a casualty in this case. There's no denying that from the very beginning they have not wanted the truth to come out. Regardless of where it would have led, they have not wanted the truth to come out. They wanted their package, design, image, program, cover story out there, and that's still what's in most people's minds. The first 48 hours, 24 hours of what was reported is still what's in most people's minds. So they've won that war on the poor.
And if you want to be a part of this process, give a call to the Police Review Board at 429-3262 and tell them you would like them to urge the police department to release the dispatch tape, which of course is the I think was probably the key piece of evidence, perhaps, we don't know, that made the Police Review Board decide that there was no problem with the case, that the police officers acted according to procedure, that the police chief acted according to proper protocols, that even though their initial report was gun was pointed, you know, threatening behavior, combat stance, that can be quickly kind of elided over with a new idea that it was simply reaching for a gun. It becomes tedious to keep repeating this, but unfortunately there is a man dead. There are police officers who are continuing to be on the beat, who one of whom killed them. There's a police chief who issued statements that seem to bear little resemblance to the truth, and there's a police review board appointed by the city council which found that was just okay, and a city council which also unanimously, and our wonderful mayor Celia Scott and Catherine Byers had apparently no objections here, ratified that process. So we got trouble here in River City, got to tell you, real trouble. David, you've been trying to crack the whip on the sleeping ban initiative, and I guess you're going to be going shortly to a meeting. What's going on with the initiative? Any words for the public on what's cooking around that?
It's not raining. If you have petitions, you should be out there circulating them. That's what's happening. The weatherman lied to us. This is a conspiracy. They're trying to make the sleeping ban fail. I don't know what the hell's going on, except that we have too many cases of we have several petitions out there, and we're not getting our signatures back in here. So if you have a petition, you have it filled out, you need to turn it back in to the person that gave it to you. Also, if you don't have a petition, what's wrong with you? You need to come to the meeting here at 706 there, at 706 Frederick Street. And that's 1:30 every Sunday. If you just want to come for a training, we'll do infield training. Come and show up at 2:30, and we'll take you out on the street and start doing the training. It's a very simple petition. Basically, you don't have much to explain to people. All you do is show them the old law and the new law that we're proposing, and they're pretty much convinced. There's not much arguing that has to be done. As a matter of fact, when you're gathering signatures, we don't encourage any arguing. That only slows the process down. We have the support we need out there. What we need is we need people to start carrying these petitions around and start getting them. Thanks to Rascals this week for taking on 60 petitions. Thanks for SCAN for having a special endorsement forum on the 28th of March. Be there. That's at Loudon Nelson Center. I believe that'll be at 11 a.m. We're having our own little big push on March 21st at Loudon Nelson, 10:30 a.m. Be there, get some petitions, and start going door to door. We need to go door to door. One problem that we have with this petition, and in case anybody from city government is listening, this is where you look for the problem, is that we, of course, since it's a city initiative, we have to be very, very careful that only city residents sign it. I have experienced sitting and talking to someone to sign the petition, asking them very, very clearly over and over and over again, you are a resident of the city of Santa Cruz, and they fill it out, and they're in Live Oak, or they're in Felton, and to them it's all Santa Cruz. But that's not what we need. We need some good petitions, so we have to, and that's why our changing gears to on the 21st to going door to door and having our big church day April 19th. And we're going to have some church days before that, but our big church day is going to be April 19th. You're hitting all the churches. We're pretty sure we'll get over the hump. But we don't want to wait till the last minute here, folks. We have the absolute deadline of May 27th. We want to have this thing done by the end of April. So get on board, call the number, come to the address, and start helping with the petition. We need help. There's no doubt that we're in a bit of trouble right now. It was a pretty rainy winter, the pneumonia winter, a flu winter. We got some setbacks, and we're in high gear now. We got the petitions out there, but I don't see the signatures coming back yet, folks.
Right, so it's an alarm. So get your butts out there. Give a call to 423-HUFF, or you can give a call also to David Silva's number, 429-5284. He can help you and get you lined up with some petitions.
A lot of new kits made up, brand new kits made up. Yeah. This morning we spent all morning making up brand new kits.
So get your kit out there on the streets and stop kidding around, or start kidding around, as the case may be. Interestingly enough, when you were doing some of this, we got a lot of interesting endorsements for the Sleeping Ban Initiative from all kinds of different folks, ranging from Geronimo Pratt. You were trying to get an endorsement at one point from Merle Evers, as I remember, and there was an interesting interchange that happened as you went up to the mic to try to get that endorsement. We actually have a bit of tape here, which may actually work. We'll see, which describes that interaction.
My one almost failure in this endorsement process. It's been an incredible endorsement process, but it wasn't a failure. It just sort of got a little waylaid, but yeah, sure, let's see. I went up to the mic. You were supposed to ask questions of Merle Evers. She's the wife of Medgar Evers, and also at that time she was the head of the NAACP. You're supposed to ask questions.
Medgar Evers, of course, was a civil rights leader assassinated in the South in 1964 in the middle of the civil rights campaign to get basic civil rights for black people, just as now we're trying to secure civil rights for homeless people.
Yeah, Merle Evers is no stranger to police lies and civic government's repression. I think perhaps the woman that was emceeing did not want to have any of this controversy. I introduced the question by saying that, right here in Santa Cruz, we have a human rights crisis that's been perpetuated for several years, and we need to resolve it, and that's what this petition is for. And I my question was, would you endorse the initiative? And she herself was sort of pushed aside, not allowed to come forward to the microphone, and interrupted and informed that was not a question.
In the city of Santa Cruz, we have a human rights crisis now. Poor people and homeless people are criminalized each night through simple act of sleeping. But there is hope. This ordinance, this partial ordinance, we have an initiative drive on the streets now for and a campaign to repeal what we call the sleeping ban. We'd like your endorsement of that campaign and possibly a statement. Thank you.
I do want to thank Mr. Sanders Williams for answering my question.
Yeah, I was I got the bums rush on that one, but I did manage wearing my union jacket and looking very straight to get up on the stage afterwards and hand her the initiative and my address, and she's going to be sending back her endorsement personally, and I'm quite confident of that. She let me know that she understood what happened, what went down.
Really?
Yeah.
Of course, that was about a month ago, and you still haven't gotten any endorsement yet.
Yeah, she's a busy woman. I mean, she's been touring the country. I would like to get that in the mail. Now, Murray, if you're listening.
Right.
The local NAACP chapter, sorry I was sick most of the winter, missed a couple of meetings, and you guys had your annual dinner. I didn't want to interrupt all those plans, but now that that's done with, we need the local NAACP chapter's endorsement.
We're sure that all those NAACP members are listening to this particular broadcast. I'm going to turn now, since all my other material has been made moot by this bizarre tape recorder, which seems to be playing lots of hums, but no dialogues and interviews. It's a pity. It's kind of strange, too.
Had to sit here and talk through the whole show?
I get to jabber. I've got an interesting article here called The Fight for Medical Marijuana, which I'm going to do a little reading on, and I guess you're off to your meeting. And
off to a couple of meetings, yeah.
Okay.
Also, the Alliance for Democracy meets today, steering committee.
All right. Well, look, I want to remind, thank you, David Silver,
sure,
for being
man.
With us. And if you want to join David at his meeting, it's going to be happening in about 20 minutes at 706 Frederick Street, where the Committee to Repeal the Sleeping Ban is attempting to get its petitions together to brave the sunshine and get out there and meet the folks. Interesting magazine called Liberty, which is sort of a libertarian magazine. The January 1998 issue has an article called The Fight for Medical Marijuana Update, by Paul Armentano. Interesting article, lots of stuff in it that I hadn't heard before and I wanted to pass on to you. It's long, so I don't know how much of it I can get through, but I may get through some of it. Some of it you know, but probably much of it you don't, and I think you may find it educational. The wheels of reform grind exceedingly slow and rough. A year has passed, actually this article is now about 3 months old, but a year has passed since California and Arizona voters approved the use of marijuana as medicine, a year of continuing legal maneuvering at both the federal and state levels. Here's a brief summary of what has happened. November 5th, voters in Arizona and California overwhelmingly approve initiatives endorsing the legal use of marijuana under a doctor's supervision. Proposition 215 in California exempts patients using marijuana medicinally from state criminal charges and also authorizes the cultivation of marijuana for medicinal purposes. Proposition 200 in Arizona states that physicians may prescribe marijuana to seriously ill patients. November 6th, Arizona Governor Fife Symington, Republican, threatens to veto Proposition 200. Symington claims that he has the authority to veto successful ballot initiatives, which pass with a simple majority of voters, but without a majority of all voters. John McDonald, Government Affairs Director for the Arizona Attorney General's Office, says that a veto by the governor would violate the state's constitution. November 9th. The Office of National Drug Control Policy issues a press release reaffirming the administration's opposition to passage of the medical marijuana initiatives. Quote, federal law is unchanged by the passage of these initiatives. The decision to bring appropriate criminal or administrative enforcement action will be decided on a case-by-case basis. November 14th, 1996, drug czar Barry McCaffrey holds a closed-door meeting with California law enforcement officials to discuss the federal response to the passage of Proposition 215. Attendance is restricted to those who oppose the legal use of medical marijuana. December 1996. December 2nd, Senator Orrin Hatch, Republican of Utah, calls a special hearing of the Senate Judiciary Committee to denounce the passage the California and Arizona initiatives. Thomas Constantine, administrator of the Drug Enforcement Administration, testifies that the federal government could, quote, take both administrative and criminal actions against doctors who violate the terms of their DEA drug registrations to prescribe controlled substances. Hatch Lamb bases the propositions as the work of pothead doctors who want to legalize drugs, quote unquote. December 9th, Symington grudgingly signs Proposition 200 in Arizona into law, but vows not to implement many of its provisions. December 12th, McCaffrey and Department of Transportation Secretary Federico Pena hold a joint press conference to announce that medical marijuana users in California and Arizona will not be granted an exemption from federal drug testing laws. A press statement announces, "The law is clear. If you are a safety-sensitive worker and you're caught using drugs, these propositions don't mean a thing. You're out of a job." December 30th, the Clinton administration announces its plan to institute criminal prosecution of physicians who prescribe or recommend marijuana in California and Arizona, and to deprive them of their right to write prescriptions of any kind. The plan further recommends that such physicians be excluded from the Medicaid and Medicare programs. The federal plan also authorizes the DEA to, quote, adopt, take over prosecution of cases resulting from seizures of marijuana and other Schedule I controlled substances made by state and local law enforcement officials in cases where state and local prosecutors cannot prosecute because of state laws. January 1997, January 8th. Citing the passage of Proposition 215, California Superior Court Judge David A. Garcia lifts a five-month injunction on the San Francisco Cannabis Buyers Club, a 10,000-member organization that distributes marijuana to seriously ill patients. Garcia rules that the club may engage in the not-for-profit cultivation and sale of marijuana for documented medical purposes. "The people of California have spoken," Garcia declares. "I don't think the California Attorney General or I are going to say that the people of California were ineffectual." January 9th. Responding to public opposition over the Clinton administration's proposal to arrest physicians who recommend or prescribe marijuana, the Office of National Drug Control Policy commits nearly $1 million to fund a comprehensive review by the National Academy of Sciences, Institute of Medicine, of the existing scientific literature regarding marijuana's medical potential. Many criticize the proposal as a, quote, stalling tactic, and emphasize that the move fails to authorize any research. The National Academy of Sciences conducted a similar review in 1982 and concluded, quote, "Cannabis and its derivatives have shown promise in the treatment of a variety of disorders." January 14th, a group of California physicians and patients file a class action suit in federal court in San Francisco seeking an injunction to prevent federal officials from taking any punitive action against physicians who recommend the medical use of marijuana to their patients in compliance with state law. January 21st, Senator Louch Faircloth, Republican of North Carolina, introduces legislation in Congress, S-40, to sanction severely physicians who prescribe or recommend the medical use of marijuana. That same day, Senator Orrin Hatch includes similar provisions in a Republican-backed anti-crime bill, S-3. January 22nd, the Massachusetts Department of Health issues regulations to create an affirmative medical defense for patients who use marijuana for a legitimate medical need. The department also begins developing a blueprint for a state-run medical marijuana research project. Governor William Weld endorses the action and states that he has no problem with the use of marijuana as a therapeutic agent. January 30th, 1997. Dr. Jerome Kassirer, editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, opines that the federal policy that prohibits physicians from prescribing marijuana to seriously ill patients is, quote, misguided, heavy-handed, and inhumane. He argues that the federal government should immediately reschedule marijuana to allow for its legal use by prescription. February 1997, February 14th, DEA agents question California family practitioner Dr. Robert Mastriani regarding evidence that he recommended marijuana to three seriously ill patients. The agents warn Mastriani that he is under formal investigation. January 20th, a panel of prominent physicians call for clinical trials to examine marijuana's therapeutic potential in the treatment of AIDS, spasticity disorders, glaucoma, and chronic pain, and the side effects of cancer chemotherapy at the close of a two-day conference organized by the National Institutes of Health. Panelists announced that a full report recommending a course of action will be released in 4 weeks. February 23rd. Four California medical groups, the San Francisco Medical Society, the California Academy of Physicians, the Gay and Lesbian Medical Association, and the Marin Medical Society, join the federal medical marijuana lawsuit filed on January 14th. March 97. March 6th. A group of physicians, health organizations, and patients file a federal lawsuit in U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia challenging the federal government's refusal to allow physicians to prescribe marijuana in states that permit them to do so. The lawsuit cites state laws in Connecticut, Virginia, and Arizona permitting physicians to prescribe marijuana for patients suffering from serious illnesses. Plaintiffs seek a declaratory judgment that the federal policy prohibiting physicians from recommending or prescribing marijuana in accordance with state law violates the First, Ninth, and Tenth Amendments and the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution. March 18th. New guidelines issued by the American Medical Association and its California affiliate, the California Medical Association, support a physician's right to discuss freely the use of marijuana as a therapeutic agent with his or her patient. April 97, April 3rd, Representative Gerald Solomon, Republican of New York, introduces a companion bill to Senator Faircloth's S-40 in the House of Representatives. The bill is titled the Medical Marijuana Prevention Act of 1997. April 15th. The Arizona legislature guts medical marijuana provisions included in Proposition 200 by approving a law mandating that state-licensed physicians may only prescribe marijuana after it has been approved by the Federal Food and Drug Administration. Backers of Proposition 200 announce that they will file a referendum to block the legislature's action. April 21st, federal agents raid flower therapy. A medical marijuana buyers club in San Francisco. Officials confiscate 331 marijuana plants, but leave dried marijuana that was marked, quote, for medicinal purposes. No federal charges are filed, and the club reopens the following day. April 24th. San Jose becomes the first city in the United States to pass zoning laws regulating cannabis buyers clubs. April 30th, U.S. District Court Judge Fern Smith rules that federal officials may not sanction California doctors who recommend marijuana to their patients in compliance with state law. Plaintiff's attorney Graham Boyd hails the ruling as a tremendous victory. May 1997, May 1st. Dr. Donald Abrams of the University of California at San Francisco submits a research proposal to NIH to study the short-term effects of marijuana on individuals suffering from AIDS. May 22nd, California Medical Association publicly endorses state legislation introduced by Senator Ron Vasconcellos to establish a medical marijuana research program at a major California university. May 27th, a group of researchers from the Montana Clinic in Missoula submit a proposal to the NIH regarding the use of marijuana in acute migraine treatment. June 97, June 1st, the Florida Medical Association, one of the largest state medical associations in the nation, passes Resolution 9761, urging state and federal governments to allow legal access to marijuana for medical purposes. June 3rd, Representative Barney Frank, Democrat of Massachusetts, introduces H.R. 1782 in Congress to provide for the medical use of marijuana in the states. The legislation eliminates the federal restrictions which currently interfere with an individual state's decision to permit the medical use of marijuana and mandates the federal government to provide marijuana for medical research purposes to all FDA-approved scientific protocols. June 16, 97, Nevada state prosecutors drop felony marijuana prosecution charges against a California cancer patient after the district attorney concedes that the marijuana was purchased in San Francisco and was for medicinal purposes only. Legal analysts claim that this is the first interstate proceeding involving medical marijuana imported from California. July 97. July 2nd, the British Medical Association overwhelmingly calls for the legalization of marijuana for medical use at a conference in Scotland. July 3rd, drug reform activists in Washington State submit more than 242,000 signatures to the Secretary of State to place the Drug Medicalization and Prevention Act of 1997 on the November 1997 ballot. Initiative 685 would allow physicians to recommend the use of marijuana or any other Schedule I drug to a seriously ill patient. The initiative also calls for substantive criminal justice reforms. July 17th, medical marijuana proponents in Arizona turn in twice the necessary number of signatures to resurrect a Proposition 200 provision allowing doctors to prescribe marijuana to seriously ill patients. August 7th, in the New England Journal of Medicine, Dr. George Anas of the Boston University School of Medicine demands that seriously ill patients be given immediate legal access to medical marijuana. Anas writes, "Research should go on, and while it does, marijuana should be available to all patients who need it to help them undergo treatment for life-threatening illnesses." August 8th. After an almost five-month delay, the NIH releases a promised report on the therapeutic potential of marijuana. The NIH report concludes that marijuana, quote, looks promising enough in the treatment of certain serious illnesses to recommend that there be new controlled studies done, and urges the federal government to play an active role in facilitating clinical evaluations of medical marijuana. White House spokesman Mike McCleary tells the AP that the administration continues to oppose the use of marijuana to treat sick people despite the NIH findings. September 12th, the California legislature fails to act on legislation introduced by Senator Vasconcelos to establish a medical marijuana research center at a campus of UC. Backers of the research proposal include American Cancer Society, Attorney General Dan Lundgren, the California Narcotics Officers Association, the California Medical Association, and the California District Attorney's Office. September 16th, federal officials provide a $170,000 grant to Washington State anti-drug coordinators to fund a full statewide anti-marijuana effort. Proponents of Initiative 685 immediately file a complaint with the Public Disclosure Commission and State Ethics Board, alleging that the federal funds are being used illegally to campaign against the Drug Medicalization and Prevention Act of 1997. Federal and state laws prohibit tax dollars from being used to fund a political campaign. September 18th. NIDA officially announces on September 18th that Dr. Donald Abrams of UC San Francisco will receive his full grant request of $978,000 for a study for the use of smoked marijuana, oral dronabinol, and a placebo in the HIV-positive patients. The aim of the revised protocol is to determine whether marijuana has serious short-term side effects on the health of HIV-positive patients. Only if the findings of this initial study, scheduled to take nearly 18 months to complete, are negative, would Abrams then be permitted to research safety and efficacy of the chronic use of marijuana for HIV-associated anorexia and weight loss. October 1st, 97, witnesses on both sides of the medical marijuana issue testify before Congress at a hearing before the House Judiciary Committee, Subcommittee on Crime. Proponents liken marijuana's medical utility and safety to drugs such as penicillin and urge the federal government to support legislative efforts to allow physicians to prescribe the drug, while opponents urge federal officials to take a more vocal stance opposing pending state marijuana initiatives. Republican anti-drug zealot Bob Barr vocally attacks libertarian witness Roger Pilon of the Cato Institute and calls spectators walking testimonials to drug use. October 8th, federal law enforcement officials raid a cannabis buyers club in Sacramento. For the first time since the passage of Proposition 215, federal arrests are issued against a California cannabis buyers club. November 1st, Americans for Medical Rights, the California-based group that spearheaded the successful passage of Proposition 215 in California, announces it will coordinate medical marijuana initiatives for 1998 in Colorado and Maine. Colorado's reform effort seeks to amend the state's constitution to allow anyone holding a state-issued identification card to legally possess up to an ounce of marijuana for medical use with a physician's recommendation. Cultivation limits are set at 6 plants, with no more than 3 plants producing usable marijuana at any one time. A similar proposal filed in Maine would limit the use of marijuana to patients suffering from AIDS, glaucoma, multiple sclerosis, or undergoing cancer chemotherapy. As in Colorado, the proposal allows patients to grow up to 6 marijuana plants. November 2nd, the NIH rejects a research proposal to study the use of marijuana in acute migraine treatment. November 4th, Initiative 685, the Drug Medicalization and Prevention Act of 1997, receives only 40% support from Washington state voters. The defeat comes as a disappointment to reformers, but medical marijuana proponents say that the public support for medical marijuana remains strong. The defeat of I-685 was not a defeat for medical marijuana, Normal Director R. Keith Stroop says, citing exit polls indicating 46% of those opposed to the initiative would support a measure dealing only with medical marijuana. It further supports our belief that a majority of Americans favor focused legislation allowing a patient to use marijuana medicinally under a physician's supervision. That's only half of this article in Liberty, the January issue of Liberty, Volume 11, Number 1. The article is The Fight for Medical Marijuana by Paul Armentano. Very good, very interesting article. I hope that you were able to pick up some of it. I kind of did a fast reading of part of it. And if you want to get a copy of it, do give me a call at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. We'll try and at least make it available to you. You have been listening to Bathrobe Spears Broadsides, Free Rights. No, they're not free. Civil Rights for the Poor. They should be free, but you got to work for them. In Santa Cruz, in California, and really around the world. This is a show that airs twice weekly, on Sunday from 11 to 1:30 and on Thursday from 6 to 8. So do join me again on Thursday, and join me at City Council meeting at 7 o'clock on Tuesday to demand that the voice of the people be heard on the issue of the Homeless Garden Project. And if you feel like it, show up at the Citizens Police Review Board 5:30 tomorrow, again at City Hall Chambers, down in right across from the library and across from the Civic Auditorium, at 5:30 to speak about your concerns about police misconduct and the need for really strong police review. I want to thank you for being with me. I apologize for those dead air spaces. We're going to go out on a little music here. Hopefully this tape is still working. And do come in and join us on Thursday at 6. And if you have any questions about anything that's been on the air, want to put anything on yourself regarding this issue, or any comments that you want played on the next show, give me a call at 423-HUFF. 423-4833. Thanks again. So hold me long.